Vitayu, welcome to this week's feature presentation from Nash Holos Ukrainian Roots Radio. I'm Pavlina, producer and host of Nash Holos, which airs weekly on AM and FM radio in Vancouver and Nanaimo, British Columbia, and of course, online. You can find program information, broadcast times, and links to the live streams and podcasts at our website, www.nashholos.com. But now, sit back, relax, and enjoy this feature interview, which was recently broadcast on the show. Now, we are in the process of lining up two speakers from Ukraine, two analysts. Eugene Libovitsky, the former news anchor on OnePlus One TV channel in Ukraine, as well as Channel 5, and he is now one of the main people, and he's a co-founder of Hromadska TV, who you heard Volodya mention earlier, and Hromadska TV means community. And so this is a public broadcasting channel in Ukraine, something that is new to Ukraine, certainly very much needed. So we'll be looking forward to getting, we're just trying to get connected with him. We do have Mykhailo Winitsky on the line, and he's just waiting for us to get connected with Yevhen. And Mykhailo grew up in Waterloo, Ontario. He has a PhD from Cambridge, and he's with the Kiev Mihaila Business School, where he works as the director of PhD programs. Mykhailo has been blogging quite extensively on the situation. He has brought forth several different aspects of it that you won't be hearing in the mainstream media. Just about there with the telephone connection. Ray, are we close? Okay, Ray is nodding. Ray Kornberger, thank you very much for being the technical assistant here. So Ray has just given me a thumbs up. We have Yevhen on the line, and we have Mykhailo on the line. Both of you, Yevhen, Mykhailo, Vitayu, they were there.
Yeah, we're here.
Oh, you're here. Awesome.
We're here. It's just I can barely hear you. I apologize. Yeah. I didn't hear the question.
Okay. No question yet. I just said, Vitayu, this is Pavida. Thank you so much for joining us here on Nash Holos.
Well, thanks
right.
for having me.
Okay, now, which one of you is Yevhen? Which one's Mykhailo?
I'm Yevhen.
Okay.
And I'm Mykhailo.
Okay. Now, the two of you had suggested, or one of you had suggested, that the two of you come on because I think you had some something that you perhaps were thinking that the two of you could impart together. Have you been working together or communicating, and was there some kind of a message that you wanted, or do you just know each other so well and want to discuss this through a broadcaster?
Well, we kind of do know each other correlatively well, but I think we've come to our careers in very different ways. Yevhen, as I understand it, is a professional journalist. I'm not. I'm more of an academic. Both of us have had spent some time on in journalism. Yevhen probably more than I have, because I was just a commentator from an academic standpoint, whereas Yevhen has been a Yevhen can tell about can say.
I was in media for 12 years, and then 7 years ago I quit media and I went into think tank, and I've been doing some research on the values of Ukrainians.
Oh, and is that published anywhere?
Some of the stuff is published, some of that stuff is being published, but actually the last couple of years I've been working on putting together a group, multidisciplinary group of experts who are actually trying to look ahead with, 10, 15 years ahead and see where Ukraine can go.
Well, it sounds like you're far ahead of your political leaders in charge of the country. As far as your thinking goes.
That's a very Ukrainian situation.
So, in case you're not aware of what Nash Holos is, we're broadcasting on campus community radio in Nanaimo, British Columbia, which I don't know if you're familiar with Canadian geography. Mykhailo, you might be. You're Canadian.
Yes, so, I was actually born in Canada. I can't say that I've actually been to Nanaimo, so I apologize. To all the Westerners that are listening to us, I'm originally from a little place called Kitchener, which is about 120 kilometers west of Toronto. I'm an Easterner, but I've been living in Kiev, and Ukraine is now home for me for the last 12 years.
Wow.
And I know that Vancouver is in the same latitude as Lviv, so that makes us quite close.
There we go. So I guess, you know, I do want to speak with you, Yevhen, about Hromadske TV, because that is very exciting to me. When I first saw that, I was just surfing around on the Internet, and I saw Hromadske TV. That's community. That's a community channel. And then I looked closer, and it is public broadcasting.
Yeah, it took quite a lot of effort to get it running, and it still will take a lot of effort to make it sustainable.
So tell us about the evolution of it.
Well, you see, the core team that actually was behind public TV, Hromadske TV, is the same team that put together Channel 5 before the Orange Revolution.
Mm-hmm.
And Channel 5 was actually the voice of the Orange Revolution, but at that time we didn't have neither the public support nor the international support to launch a TV station, and at that time equipment would cost much more than right now because of technological change. And so basically we had to strike a deal with the nicest of the oligarchs at that time, and so we knew that it's not going to be a long-term successful deal.
Mm-hmm.
But Channel 5 played its role. Now, 9 years after, we decided that we are ready for a second try, and so far it's successful.
Wow, so you made a deal with the devil as an interim measure, and now you have your own public radio or public broadcasting.
Oh, come on, I'm gonna jump in here, because
okay.
Poroshenko is far from being the devil.
Oh, okay,
so
okay.
I realize that that Yuhan's relationship with him may be a little bit different than mine, but I teach in a business school, and I have a lot of respect for what that particular, as Yuhan calls him, oligarch. I have a problem with that term in his particular case, but I have a lot of respect for the way he runs his businesses and the way he treats his people, and most importantly, his patriotic stance, particularly as has been shown over the last couple of days, with the current revolution that's ongoing in Kyiv.
Now Poroshenko.
Well,
sorry, go ahead.
I'll take the benefit of not commenting that.
So, whoa, agree to disagree. Well, okay.
Modus vivendi is the thing that you have to apply in Ukraine if you want to be successful.
Sorry, what was that?
Modus vivendi is a usual thing one has to apply in Ukraine if you want to be successful.
Modus vivendi, very good. Now, just as an aside, Mikhailo Poroshenko, you were saying, is not really as bad. He's not really a bad guy. He's just kind of doing what he has to do to keep afloat in the rather toxic business environment in Ukraine. So what is he doing? Does he still have Channel 5? And is it still broadcasting?
Yes, Channel 5 is definitely broadcasting. Channel 5 clearly is not, I mean, it's not as active in the current events as it was in the Orange Revolution, and I would say that has less to do probably with the ownership than with the team that now works at Channel 5, because, I mean, Yuhan at one point, as he put it, struck a deal with the devil to get some money, but nevertheless put together at Channel 5 9 years ago really a dream team of journalists. Many of those people have gone on to do many other things, including one of the key people is now in Parliament as an opposition mm-hmm. deputy, Governor Vadim Shevchenko. So, I mean, it clearly channels and media are made first and foremost by professional journalists, and the team that was there in 2004 is incomparable to the team that's there today, and I as a viewer can certainly say that. But at the same time, we have a lot more to choose from in Ukraine when it comes to media, which is very good, including internet media, which I think we've come full circle to. So I think it's very important that current events are actually being followed first and foremost on the internet, and then on TV. I've actually got Channel 24 turned on in front of me at the moment, and that's probably my main source of TV news, and then that's followed up certainly by internet stuff.
Now, I have a question about that. I was speaking with a local political analyst, and he said when he was checking on the internet and all the different news channels and sources that there still was some censorship going on with the major media outlets in Ukraine, and they were resorting to the old Soviet technique of playing Swan Lake when instead of covering protests. Is that how can they do that still and get away with that now that everyone has a cell phone? Even people, the poorest people, have cell phones, and so they've got internet. Are they still doing this, and why?
Well, because Ukraine doesn't have freedom of speech. Ukraine has pluralism of dependencies, which makes Ukraine way more advanced than other former Soviet countries, where pluralism is unachievable in most of the cases. But it's still pluralism of dependencies. And where I would probably agree that Channel 5 is still one of the better channels on the Ukrainian market. But the reason why the Dream Team didn't stay on Channel 5 is exactly the ownership issue.
Hmm.
The problem is that Ukraine is a bottom-up country where the major decisions are taken at grassroots. That means that leadership in Ukraine must be basically a service, whereas the Ukrainian leaders, including the oligarchs, including the owners of big businesses that were privatized, are trying to run the country in a very despotic way. So leadership, in their understanding, is not serving, but actually, taking the decisions for others without letting those others have a say. And that affects, as a matter of fact, media situation with democracy, situation with private entrepreneurship, and everything else.
I mean, obviously, the media is having an effect on the people because it's mobilizing Ukrainians. They seem to be losing their fear and inhibitions. But what about the leadership?
What about the leadership? Yuhens brought up an interesting point in that Ukraine, I think my interpretation of what he said was that Ukrainians are culturally disposed to being a sort of a bottom-up kind of society, mm-hmm. which is probably pretty true. I mean, this is a country that has a tradition of being, and this is a historical tradition, if you like, of very long-term periods of stability and a lot of patience from society, and then things quite suddenly sort of blow up. And there's uprisings, and now the uprisings are generally sort of they generally tend to be against rulers, and I think that if you bring that on to sort of the way that companies are run and the way media is run, and I think it's a sort of those are microcosms of the way society operates here. It's quite democratic, some would actually say, and in a lot of cases, perhaps a little bit anarchic, but at the same time there are leaders that try to put a little order onto that, and that order very often gets interpreted as being authoritarianism. In this particular case, in the political sphere, clearly the authoritarianism has gone way too far, mm-hmm. and the calls on the streets are for a change of leadership, and that change of leadership call, that if you like, that revolutionary sort of flywheel is gaining in intensity. So I think we're in for a standoff that's going to last for a very, very long time yet.
Mm. Mykhailo Banitsky and Yevhen Hlibovsky are our guests, and they will be back. We do need to take a break for some messages at the top of the hour, but Mykhailo, Yevhen, please stay on the line. We'll be back to continue this conversation in 2 minutes.
This is Corwin Miller, and you're listening to CHLY, broadcasting to Canada's West Coast on 101.7 and around the world at chly.ca.
And this is Nasholos Ukrainian Roots Radio Special Edition covering the protests in Ukraine on CHLY 101.7 FM. I'm Pavlina Demchuk-McQuarrie, your host, and our guests right now are Mykhailo Banitsky and Yevhen Hlibovsky in Ukraine. Welcome back, Yevhen and Mykhailo. Now, just before we took our break, Mykhailo, you were saying that you felt that this was a standoff that was going to be quite a while, but yet I've been reading some of your blog reports, and you mentioned that Yuri Lutsenko, one of the leaders of the current opposition movement, predicted a 5-day revolution, but I think we're beyond five now, aren't we?
No, we're not. Look, this is when it comes to timelines, this is when things get a little bit iffy. We are actually on day 4 of the revolution.
Okay.
I think that's important for us to understand, because what was happening prior to Saturday morning, 4 o'clock Kyiv time, this was a very different country. this was a country that had a small group of protesters, primarily students, young people, that were brought together by Facebook and Twitter, and were kind of romantically, I guess, protesting against the fact that, you know, the government had stopped European integration, and Yanukovych was sort of, there was still some hope that he would actually sign in Vilnius. And if you look at my first blog, I was actually betting the fact that, you know, he would actually sign, and I was being optimistic. And there was a bunch of people, primarily students, on Independence Square. It was a sort of a festive carnival kind of atmosphere. And then on Saturday morning at 4 o'clock in the morning, for the first time in Ukraine's independent history, there was blood on the streets of Kyiv, because the riot police decided that it was time to clear out the demonstration, even though the demonstrators were actually dissipating on their own. There was only about 300 or 400 of them left, and the deal was that everybody was basically packing, that on Sunday would be the last demonstration, the last protest, and everybody was sort of had agreed that we were disbanding. And then suddenly the riot police came in and beat people, quite frankly, savagely.
Wow.
And then on Saturday it was a bit of a state of shock, because those people that were able to get away from the riot police, the Berkut, actually took refuge in Mikhailovsky Sobor, which is a church that actually was built or rebuilt. It was destroyed by Stalin, and it was rebuilt with Canadian and American diaspora funds. And there's a monastery there now. And they took refuge in that monastery. And there's a lot of really heartening kind of pictures of people basically hiding behind gates and sleeping on the floor of a church. By Sunday, Ukraine got angry. And that Sunday, we had 500,000 people on the streets. And that was when the real revolution started. That was last Sunday. Sunday evening, there was a lot of provocateurs. There was an attempt to create more violence. Clearly, that was done for the cameras. Clearly, that was done in order to try to have the protesters blamed for the violence, which, in fact, was completely... I mean, the demonstrations have been completely peaceful. The violence has all come from the regime side. But nevertheless, the point is that on Sunday, Ukraine changed, because 500,000 people on the streets, they were not protesting for Europe anymore. This whole thing is not about Europe anymore. It's not about European integration. Huh. It's about regime violence, and it's about a regime that, quite frankly, has gotten so far away from its people and has absolutely no regard for human life. And people are basically saying that they don't want to live that way.
Wow. Now, this is very different from 2004. How, in your view, what do you see as the most significant differences?
Well, you see, 2004 was, I would say, a simplified version of fight for democracy, because basically it came down to fighting for Yushchenko, for the person that had to win, in the opinion of the protesters. But not for democracy as a set of rules. What happened with the Ukrainian society in these last 10 years is that it grew up to understand that rules are more important than personalities. And this Maidan is about the rules that we will live along with.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I think I'll agree with the statement that it's about rules. I think that is true. But I think that the main difference that I'm seeing, and this is something that perhaps it'll change over time, but in 2004, first of all, it was extremely well organized. We have to understand that there was a very well organized, well funded political machine that had planned the protests well in advance, because it was quite understood prior to the vote in the presidential elections that there would be falsifications. And, I mean, as a participant in that whole thing, then in 2004, it was very obvious that it wasn't obvious to me at the time, but it's become obvious over time that there was a lot of things that were extremely well planned and quite well organized by political machines. This time, it's not well organized. And the difference also is that then it was, people were angered by falsifications, but they were protesting in favor of. So it was a sort of a positive protest. People were there was constantly positive messages put out onto the crowds. Today, the message is, it's very difficult to make a positive message when the reason that people are protesting is because they don't want their kids to be killed. And they don't want violence, and they don't want, and they want to live in a way where you can actually walk up to a policeman and possibly ask for directions and not worry about the fact that he's going to either rob you blind or beat you to death. That's what this protest is about. We've had some run-ups to this protest, and that's been, we've had a savage rape of a woman in a little village in southern Ukraine called Vradyivka, in Mykolaivka Oblast, where she was raped by three police officers. And the village people basically came out and stormed the local government administrative building, and including the police station. In other words, there's been some foreshadowing to all of this, and this is not an isolated event when it comes to police brutality. So this is very much a revolution against. 2004 was a big party. And yeah, it was dangerous. Yeah, there was a lot of tension, but in comparison, you know, that was kind of Woodstocky. This one's not about, you know, getting out on the streets and singing songs. At the same time, there's some very positive things that are coming out of it, and I think that it's also a lot got a lot to do with patriotism. I don't think I've ever sang the Ukrainian hymn. This, you know, "Strenna Narodna Ukraina" is the hymn of Ukraine. I don't think I've ever sang it as often in my life. You sing it on the hour when you're standing on Independence Square. So it's kind of a way of gathering people together. But that's nevertheless not a positive thing necessarily. It's still very much a protest against the regime.
Well, it sounds to me like that. Oh, sorry, Yevhen, go ahead.
Yeah, I would also add that this, that it has some specifics that are not usual for the developed world. For instance, in Ukraine, the fault line lies between the civil society and the entire political elite. So I would say that the both the government and the opposition are quite foreign to, quite strange to the civil society. And this is an uprising of the civil society, and this is why it's so unorganized, chaotic at first in the beginning, and that's why it's so difficult to actually get the things going and spinning. What we feel is the gap, because the politicians basically are lagging behind. They don't really understand what's happening in the society. And this is why the political opposition doesn't find it easy to capitalize on these protests.
It sounds to me like since 2004, Ukrainians as a society have grown up a little bit, have had their rose-colored glasses shattered a little bit, and are now facing the reality and taking the bull by the horns and matters into their own hands.
Well, this is exactly the field.
Go ahead, one of you talk.
go ahead.
Or I will.
I was going to just say that the rose-colored glasses are certainly off. There is definitely a cleavage or a tension between, massive tension between people and politicians, which is what you had mentioned. I would mention one other thing. 9 years has gone by, and the people that are the core protesters this year, or this time, if you like, never lived in the Soviet Union. They were born after the Soviet Union fell apart. There's a generational change, and that, I think, is a very important thing as well. Because in 2004, the core protesters still had a memory of the Soviet Union, and many of them actually sort of spent at least their formative years in high school, let's say, in the Soviet period. That's not true today. It's actually interesting because there are people that quite frankly, the students are, and some of the protesters are looking for guidance. In other words, I'm not sure that I would call them the older generation, because Yuri Lutsenko, for example, is just a little older than me. He's 45. But he's actually reluctant to provide that guidance because he sees that it's a different kind of revolution. It's a different kind of thing that, and I think that there's a lot of that people are, to some extent, he's not providing guidance. At the same time, the young people don't particularly want the guidance because youthful exuberance is the way it is. Look, if you want to compare what's going on right now to anything, don't compare it to 2004. The closest comparison is Tahrir Square in Egypt, in Cairo. It's things like what I, God forbid, but it's Libya. It could be Syria, and the best outcome would be it's like a Tunisia. What we're seeing is kind of an Arab Spring in very, very different, mind you, weather conditions.
But Ukrainian winter.
I would also say that it has something from the Occupy movement, you see, what's been happening over the last 10 years were different things. Like, for instance, Ukraine had unprecedented economic growth between 1998 and 2008, and then very deep impact of the financial crisis. Ukrainian GDP shrunk 14% in 2009, and then Yanukovych, who made the political life quite rough. All these factors, though were aiming in different directions, actually contributed to one thing, which was maturing of the civil society and maturing of the middle class. And even though the vectors were different, it all contributed to the same thing. And this is the outcome that we see right now. Middle class is strong. There are young people who are joining the street. These young people have different values than the people who lived under the Soviet Union and remember Soviet Union. And this is definitely a shift. This is a very serious change.
Yeah, that's interesting because it speaks to something that, Mikhailo, that you had written in one of your posts, I think it was the one on optics, is that Yanukovych has been going on and on explaining his position in terms of the economy, but people aren't interested in money. They're more interested in values, I think was how you put it.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, this is again, the cleavage between the people and the politicos. Because the politicos are convinced that it's, and first of all, we have to realize that the politicians that are in power at the moment, and Yanukovych and his entourage are generally from one particular area of the country called the Donbass. It's a very materialistic kind of area, which is, it's industrialized, it's heavily industrialized, with coal mines and metallurgy and that sort of thing. And their discourse is about money, and their discourse is about jobs, and their discourse is about sort of quality of life in very, very material terms. And that's clearly, I mean, obviously, economics is important to everybody, particularly if you want to live. There are also other things that are important, and this is the thing that you had mentioned about middle-class values. The people that are protesting don't have ambitions to be rich. They have ambitions to build careers. That's a very different discourse. Building a career is about self-actualization and self-realization. And yeah, money is a part of it, but it's not about money. Whereas and I think that's why the European values or the European, if you like, lighthouse is so attractive to those people, because Europe lives that way. Europe is about values. Europe is about careers. Europe is about a lifestyle and a social safety net and educational quality and that sort of thing. And those are the things that are important to people today, which is something that the people in power have absolutely no notion of. And unfortunately, I would agree with Johan in that I think that the opposition politicians also don't understand that. Or perhaps they do understand it, but or they understand it a little better than those that are in power today, but they certainly don't come from the same value set as the young people that started this whole issue.
Do you think there's any hope for the people in power, people aspiring to power, to finally for that message to get through to them?
This is one of these cases where, if you asked me an hour ago, I'd probably give you a different answer. Things are changing very, very rapidly on the ground, and my emotions are going from radical optimism to radical pessimism. When I make parallels to Tunisia, then I'm optimistic because that's where we had a transfer of power that was relatively peaceful. And when I start going into my Libya concept, then it gets really, really rough. That means I'm being very pessimistic. Mm-hmm. I don't see Yanukovych giving up power peacefully, unfortunately. I don't see Yanukovych and his band of thugs giving up power without a fight. And I don't see the protesters disbanding anytime soon. And I don't see them being particularly violent, because the whole idea of peaceful protest is something that's very, very core to the current Maidan. Mm-hmm. And it's a core value of Ukrainians, I think, in general. Mm-hmm. So this is going to be a standoff that's going to last for a long, long time to come. I had somebody that dropped me a line on Facebook the other day asking if this would be over by Christmas, and mm-hmm. I said my answer was, I really hope it's over by Easter.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I would just add to that I think we're going to be fine unless there is really a violent scenario, and any serious violent scenario probably would involve a third country, and mainly we're talking about Russia. So, you know, unless it gets violent, it will be all right.
Well, as they say, we live in interesting times. I hope that everything will work out well for you in Ukraine. Thank you so much, Mykhailo and Yevhen, for joining us and sharing your insights. This is a lot of what you've mentioned has not been reported in the media. There's not been much analysis, and so it's very good to hear your perspective from living there and experiencing Ukraine, the protests in Ukraine.
Thanks for having us, and I just want to make a final point, if mm-hmm. I may. Mm-hmm. I've actually been flipping through the channels once in a while, watching CNN, BBC. Unfortunately, I don't get access to CBC here except through the internet. I'm disappointed that these issues, which are quite frankly earth-shattering in my opinion, are not getting enough coverage in the Western press.
Yes.
So if you have any, if Ukrainians or others in Canada, if Canadians in general, have any kind of influence on your reporters, it might be a good idea to get some more people here on the ground, because quite frankly, we need it.
I'm joining Mykhailo on this one.
Awesome. Well, you know what? That's very, very much shared by Canadians as well. So, what is there something that we can do? You said, somehow exert influence. But there's only so much that we can do with our colleagues. And, we're here in community radio, much like you, Yevhen Hromadske, radio. And so, I guess, for lack of anything more descriptive, they don't listen to us. So, do you have any other ideas what we can do?
Look, I think, in my opinion, the important thing is that to get information out. Yanukovych is a person not just Yanukovych, I'll make a generalization. Authoritarian rulers are afraid of two things. Internal dissent that can challenge their power, and challenges to their external reputations. And I think that clearly this has to be an issue that's resolved internally within the country.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, external pressure can be very effective. And that external pressure is basically a reputational kind of pressure. So the more mm-hmm. reporting that we have from Kyiv, the more, and other cities, not just Kyiv, but the better. I get really annoyed when I see a report about Kyiv on CNN being broadcast from a reporter from Moscow. I mean,
that
doesn't make a lot of sense.
Drives
it's
us
like
crazy, too.
Reporting on issues that have to do with Canadian politics from Washington.
Exactly.
It really doesn't make a lot of sense to do
mm-hmm.
that.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. I mean, that's a whole other issue that we have here in the diaspora, is to educate the North American media as well, and that's a whole other ball of wax. But for now, I guess it certainly wouldn't hurt to keep the Facebook posts and the tweets flying, and pictures, and anybody, I suppose, any Canadians that have a hankering to go to Ukraine, this would be a good time, taking Christmas as well, I suppose. but also...
Well, I will say that I met with... I was at a reception today. Foreign Minister Baird is in the country at the moment. He made some statements today that were very supportive of democracy building. Clearly, as a diplomat, he can't be as open in his support as we would like him to be. But nevertheless, the fact that Canadian Foreign Minister is here, the German Foreign Minister is here also, the Swedish and the Norwegian, they're here for an OECD meeting. Many of the foreign ministers actually canceled their trips because of what's going on.
Oh.
But Canada actually did something that I think is interesting, and that is they're trying to engage both the protesters and the Ukrainian government, and they are giving a message to the protesters, which is one of moral support. And to the government, they're basically saying, look, you need to do something about this. And the fact that the president happens to be on a, quote, business trip to China at the moment, when he's got 40,000 people protesting in his in his capital, maybe that's not the greatest of management decisions to be made.
Indeed, indeed. Well, we're all following this very closely. Mikhailo, can you tell us where we can find information, how people can follow you with your blog posts, because they're very enlightening.
Thank you. Well, I actually I'm doing this informally. I'm posting on Facebook, but I also have some people that are kind enough to repost for me because I'm sending this out as an email. The first thing is that Dominique Arel from the University of Ottawa has something called the UKL, which is the Ukraine list, which is reactivated now with current events. So you can Dominique Arel is the chair of Ukrainian studies at the University of Ottawa, and you can find him on his website and ask to be included to that email list. And Andy Holowaty, who is from Toronto, has set up a website for English language media about Ukraine, but unfortunately I don't remember the URL.
Well, you know what, that
been posting things that
well, that's okay. I mean,
you can find that.
No worries. Actually, you know, we can stay in touch after the show, and we can put that on the website. Unfortunately, our time is pretty much run out. So thank you once again so much for joining us, for sharing this insight behind the scenes, and we will stay in touch, and you stay safe, both of you.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you.
Dobranich.
Dobranich.
And we were speaking with Mikhailo Vinitsky and Yevhen Hlibovitsky from Ukraine regarding the protests in Ukraine and interesting things that are coming about as a result. I hope you enjoyed this week's feature interview from Nash Holos Ukrainian Roots Radio. In addition to interviews such as the one you just heard, Nash Holos is host to many other outstanding features produced by people who love to share their love of Ukrainian culture with non-Ukrainian speakers. From Ukrainian recipes and cooking tips to reviews of English language books on Ukrainian themes, views on Ukrainian politics and current affairs, culture, folklore, and of course great Ukrainian music, traditional and contemporary, by artists from Ukraine, Canada, and around the world. So join me, Pavlina, and my fascinating guests on the weekly radio broadcasts in Vancouver and Nanaimo. You can listen to the live broadcasts on air or online, or download the podcast and listen later in your own good time. You'll find program information, broadcast details, and podcast links at www.nashholos.com. So until next time, dopa bachinya.